Okay. No, we're not. That's the problem. Okay. How's that? All right. Getting it right. Okay. Well, a problem in astrophysics has been, how can we measure the expansion of the universe with sufficient precision over the entire age of the universe? And typically what we do is we measure the distances to certain galaxies, then we find, say, a supernova in that galaxy, and we take what are called the type 1A supernova, which have the same brightness wherever they are in the universe, and therefore by measuring their luminosity of the star, we can figure out how far away that object is, and we can measure the redshift, how fast that galaxy is moving away from us, and that gives us a measure. Well, the most spectacular evidence we have for supernatural design in any of the sciences has to do with the change in the expansion rate for the universe. Gravity works to slow down the expansion rate. Dark energy, the energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe, works to accelerate the expansion of the universe. Both must be exquisitely fine-tuned in order to have the universe expand at just the right rate, at just the right time throughout cosmic history, so you get stars and planets showing up at the right time. And astronomers have calculated that in order to get the planets and stars that are necessary for advanced life to exist at the right time in the history of the universe, you have to fine-tune the mass of the universe, which is a factor that governs gravity. The greater the mass, the more powerful the effect of gravity. That must be fine-tuned to within one part in a quadrillion, 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 or one part in 10 to the 60th, if you like that instead. But they discovered that the dark energy term must be fine-tuned to within one part in 10 to the 122nd power. Now, everywhere else in the sciences, in terms of our arguments for the supernatural design of the universe or the Earth or its life for the benefit of life, the best we can come up with is a fine-tuning rate of about one part in 10 to the 40th. So in terms of the expansion of the universe, we have evidence, scientific evidence, that's literally quadrillions of times more spectacular than we have anywhere in any other sciences. I'm not saying you won't find more spectacular evidence than we have in the expansion of the universe, because in the complex sciences of biology, that potential certainly exists, but the problem is we lack the measuring tools, the instruments to measure the degree of fine-tuning. The benefit of astronomy is things are so simple, we can measure things with high precision. However, the difficulty is the farther away you go in the universe, which means the farther back in time you're seeing, because it takes light time to travel to our telescopes, the fainter the objects. And therefore, in terms of trying to measure the expansion rate of the universe with any great deal of precision, it basically stops at about 8 billion light years, which means we're only able to see about the last half of the history of the universe. And by measuring the first last half of the history of the universe, we try to infer what was going on in the very beginning. But many astronomers believe in the early history of the universe, there's hidden fine-tuning that we've not yet discovered. The problem or the challenge is, how do we get measurements more distant than, say, 7 or 8 billion light years? Because at that point, the galaxies are really too faint for us to get high precision measurements. Well, what a group of astronomers did, and this is in this issue of Nature, the one that was published just a few days ago. You can see the paper here. And by the way, you can always get the abstract free of charge by going to the Nature website. If you want the whole article, they'll charge you $30, which is why we subscribe to the magazine, because we'd be spending tons of money getting the articles otherwise. But the abstracts are always free.
What is the website?
Nature.com. That's quite easy, www.nature.com. So, but what astronomers realize is that the galaxies in the universe are distributed on what we call a web, a cosmic web. And this is an actual map of the nearby universe. And what we're seeing here are the maps of the superclusters. Maybe we can dim the light a little bit, maybe you'll see this a little more easily. And what we're seeing here are not clusters of galaxies, but superclusters of galaxies. A supercluster is a cluster of clusters of galaxies. So each cluster would have, you know, say, several million galaxies within it. But what you notice here is that you've got spots where you've got loads of galaxies all tightly grouped together, and then you've got these big voids. So here's the Bootes void, the Sculptor void, the Capricornus void, regions where there's very few galaxies in there. Incidentally, our own Milky Way galaxy is in one of the smaller of the voids. Good thing, because if you're smack in the middle of a supercluster of galaxies, the gravity of adjoining galaxies would make advanced life impossible in your galaxy. Well, this is a nearby universe, but as you go farther and farther out, the wedge structure of the universe becomes more obvious, where you can see voids and then the galaxies distributed on these web or string-like pictures. The most famous one is called the Sloan Great Wall, which exists here. It's the biggest of the webs of the universe. And then this is a very recent research study where, okay, you see this region here that's been mapped out? That's this little square here. So that's how much of the universe we've been able to measure the web-like structure. But the universe, the observable universe, is actually much larger. Well, what researchers did is taking the known physics of the universe and the requirement that the universe would grow or evolve in such a fashion as to produce the stars and planets and galaxies that would make life possible, they were able to model what the web structure of the entire universe would look like. A fundamental requirement for life to exist in the universe is that it must be both homogeneous and uniform, which means a detailed map we've made in the small section of the sky where we can come up with sufficiently detailed measurements must be representative of the rest of the universe. Because if the rest of the universe is different, that would negate the possibility of life ever existing in the universe. Now, what a group of astronomers did is they made the point, since we can't really look at a single galaxy at distances beyond 8 or 9 or 7 or 8 billion light years away with sufficient precision to get an accurate measurement of both its distance and its velocity with respect to us, how about if we grab measurements on a whole bunch of galaxies, which means they'd have a bright light. So what they did is they found filaments along the web of the universe where many galaxies were jammed very tightly together, so tightly together that at low resolution they would appear as a single object in the telescope. And what they did is they measured the frequency or the wavelength of what's called the neutral hydrogen line. Now, why did they pick that? Because it's the most predominant spectral line that we can measure anywhere in astronomy. The universe, after all, in terms of its ordinary matter, is about 76% hydrogen. And so the neutral hydrogen line would be the strongest of the lines. And by finding aggregates where you've got, say, thousands of galaxies in a kind of a tight knot along one of the web filaments, they're able to get a combined light strength from there that enables them to measure the expansion of the universe with high precision, not just 7 billion light years away, but 10, 12, and 13 billion light years away. Now, what they did in this article published in Nature is they simply proved that the technique works. They have not yet come up with a measurement of the expansion history of the universe in its first 7 billion years, but they said we now have the tool to make that possible, and with that tool, we have the potential for uncovering a design that's currently hidden from view. Yes?
Are these filaments consist of the aggregate light of a lot of galaxies, or is there something else consists of the filaments themselves?
It's basically the light of the galaxies. In other words, this web-like structure you're seeing with these filaments. Each filament would be like a line segment with millions of galaxies all along that line. And a requirement for life is that indeed the universe would have a web-like structure where you've got these strong concentrations of galaxies along these web filaments, and in between you've got voids where very few galaxies exist. So what these astronomers are doing is they're picking certain, like for example, this particular web portion right here, you notice how bright it is. Lots and lots of superclusters of galaxies there, and so they can integrate on that spot with a low resolution telescope and now get enough of a signal from the hydrogen line that they can measure the expansion of the universe at that appropriate distance.
Okay, now, how does that, these filaments and the galaxies that comprise them relate to galaxy clusters?
Okay, along, say, this particular filament, what you have is a line of a whole bunch of clusters of galaxies very tightly spaced with respect to one another. And, you know, the secret here is to use relatively low resolution so that you're actually picking up the light signal of the entire knot of clusters and superclusters of galaxies. And, you know, given that they're all at roughly the same, I mean, what you're getting is an average distance, but, you know, if you get enough galaxies involved there, that average distance will be sufficiently accurate that you can measure the expansion of the universe at that distance. Because the big challenge in cosmology today is to determine whether the universe's, whether dark energy is governed by a constant or a set of constants. And right now the evidence is telling us one constant seems to be governing it, but there could be multiple constants. And in order to determine that, it's important to be able to observe the history of the universe when it was very young, only billions of years old, instead of the current 14 billion years. Yes?
Would this also provide proof, for example, that the speed of light is constant and other physical constants?
Yes, it would. Yeah. Well, that's already pretty well pinned down, but this technique will allow that to be pinned down with more precision. So yeah, I mean, you could use this as a means of testing the constancy of the laws of physics. I mean, you know, the Bible speaks about the expansion of the universe. It also speaks about the laws that govern the heavens as being fixed throughout the history of the universe. And this technique will allow you to put both of those biblical statements about the universe to a more thorough test. But for the first time, astronomers have a tool that will give them the expansion history of the universe when it was very young instead of just the last half of the history of the universe. So once they got some measurable results, I'll tell you what it all is all about, but I'm confident in predicting it's going to reveal more evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design than we have right now. So that was that particular issue of Nature. In the previous issue, which was about 9 days ago, this particular paper was published, and it's all about the chicken and the human. And what they did is they came up with a complete record or analysis of the chicken Z chromosome compared with the human X chromosome. See what's going on here? Well, it's about the sex chromosomes of birds and mammals. And with birds, the male carries the ZZ sex chromosome. The female carries the ZW. And with mammals, it's just the opposite. With mammals, it's the male that has the XY and the female has the double X. So if we go back to the birds, it's the male that has the double Z, and then the female has the ZW, and with mammals, it's just the opposite. And, you know, in terms of really trying to understand the history of life on the planet Earth, there's a lot of interest because of the differences between birds and mammals with respect to the sex chromosomes to actually come up with the complete genomics for those chromosomes. That's what this paper is all about. We now have that intact. But the results they got were completely opposite to what they expected. Now, this paper is written by evolutionary biologists who buy into the Darwinian paradigm, and so their belief is that these sex chromosomes came about as a result of the evolution of what are called autosomes. That just simply means a non-sex chromosome. And so the chromosomes in all species, you've got what are called autosomes, which are simply non-sex chromosomes, and compared with the sex chromosomes. In fact, the authors in this paper are arguing that we only refer to the sex chromosomes as chromosomes and call everything else autosomes. But their belief was that autosomes evolved over time to produce the sex chromosomes. But what was startling to them in this analysis is they found out that the Z and the let me make sure I get this right. Yes, the Z and the X for the chicken and the human. So we've only done it with the human beings compared with chickens, but they believe this will be representative of birds and mammals in general. As they discovered that these chromosomes are remarkably similar to one another. And so the title of the paper is Convergent Evolution of the Chicken Z and Human X Chromosomes by Expansion and Gene Acquisition. So the paper begins with the assumption that these sex chromosomes came about through the naturalistic evolution of autosomes. But what was startling to them is that they wind up with virtually the same outcome for both birds and mammals. Evolution, after all, is a relatively random process, and you should get different results. I've talked here in the class, and it's in our book, More Than a Theory, how experiments done in the lab by Michigan State University have proved that indeed Stephen Jay Gould is right, that natural evolutionary mechanisms will never repeat. What we have here is an example of a repeated outcome. You get the same outcome for the birds as you do for the mammals, but the real shock is, notice the reversal. For the birds, you get the ZZ, whereas for the mammals, it's the other way around. And so the expectation was that they were going to get dramatically different results. Let me just give you a few quotes from the paper so you can hear what the authors had to say for themselves. Here's the first: comparison of the chicken Z chromosome with a human Y chromosome demonstrates that each evolved independent of one another. So for the birds, you've got an independent line of evolution compared to the mammals. And the next comment is, despite this independence, the chicken Z and the human X share features that distinguish them from the autosomes. So they made a detailed comparison of the sex chromosomes for birds relative to the autosomes. They did the same thing for the mammals using the human and the chicken. But they discovered that in both cases, they share similar features that depart radically from what we see in the autosomes. And here's another conclusion. The avian Z and the mammalian X follow convergent evolutionary trajectories despite their evolving with opposite heterogametry. That's just a technical term for the fact that it's in the male where you have the double chromosome, the ZZ, for birds, whereas for mammals, it's the other way around. It's the female that carries the double, not the male. And finally, they said in birds and mammals, sex chromosome evolution involved not only gene loss, but also marked expansion and gene acquisition. And as you read throughout the paper here, that is probably the most stunning conclusion they were drawing here, is just how remarkably different these sex chromosomes are from the autosomes, and yet the differences compared to birds and mammals are virtually the same. And this is something you would never anticipate from a Darwinian evolutionary perspective, but it's exactly what you'd anticipate if a creator was engineering the sex chromosomes for both the birds and the mammals. And of course, you'd expect to see similarities, because what's optimal for birds in terms of sex will also be optimal for mammals in terms of sex. So you'd expect to see similar designs in each. But given the degree of genes you've got to pull out from the autosomes and the new genes you've got to stick in, they said this is something that is completely startling from an evolutionary perspective. Nevertheless, when they finish up their paper, they basically just kind of punt and say, we don't know what to do with this, but it is an extremely startling outcome from an evolutionary perspective. But there's no comment there that it's exactly what you'd expect from an intelligent creator designing these genes. Now, my colleague Fuzz Rana is writing this up. He's also producing a podcast. He's probably already done so. I've been out of the office for the past several days. I'm sure he's on top of this. So if you go to our website, in all likelihood be able to find both an article and a podcast from Fuzz on this. He's actually building up a catalog of examples of what evolutionists refer to as repeated evolutionary outcomes, what we refer to as repeated design outcomes. Fuzz's catalog now exceeds over 400 specific examples of these repeated outcomes we see in the history of life. Now, the reason why he's building this catalog, evolutionists can say, well, maybe a repeated outcome can happen by pure chance. Maybe once it can happen by pure chance. It's not going to happen hundreds of times by pure chance. And also, you can go to our website, and we interviewed a few years ago Simon Conway Morris. He is an evolutionist, but he's the one that's been pointing out the hundreds of examples of repeated evolutionary outcomes, and basically has been arguing the Darwinian paradigm must be overturned and replaced. Now, he's not claiming that this is evidence for supernatural intervention. Simon Conway Morris's position is there are hidden laws of physics that explain these repeated outcomes. So that's one reason why we had some physicists as well as biologists interview Simon Conway Morris, because from a standard of, from a physics perspective, there's no way such a law of physics could be hidden from the view of a research physicist and astronomers. If such laws exist, they would have to be exposed. Matter of fact, we have argued in our writings that such laws exist, it would actually rule out the possibility that life would exist in the universe. So it's a self-defeating argument. Bottom line is, you need something supernatural. Yes?
If I were an evolutionist, I would argue that maybe from an engineering standpoint, there is, in any particular system that you're studying, there's one optimal way to perform something.
Right.
And that evolution will find that one way, and that maybe that would explain these examples of repeated evolution.
Well, the long-term evolution experiments, if that was really what was going on, and there was hidden laws of physics that would explain these repeated outcomes, those experiments would show it. They don't. What they show instead is that Gould is right. Evolution does not repeat. It comes up with different results every time. And so I know of three long-term evolution experiments that are currently running, but all of them show random outcomes rather than repeated outcomes. However, we do see evidence, because what these evolutionary biologists are doing are looking at the long-term history of birds and mammals. They've been around for at least 100 million years in each case, but from the biblical perspective, that puts you into the six creation days. And so long-term evolution experiments run in real time show you what's happening when God's at rest. They don't show you what's happening when God is active. God creates for 6 days, he rests on the seventh day. And so this really explains why we're seeing different things in the fossil record than we see in real time, and different things with molecular clocks when we're looking back in time than we see today. Today, you're not going to see the supernatural interventions because God's at rest, but you will see it in the past. So that's a conundrum that these researchers are struggling with. Something they discovered that was not at all anticipated from an evolutionary perspective. Nevertheless, they report the results as they come out. So they basically don't draw any conclusions in the paper. It's basically an announcement. Here is a very startling outcome. Yes?
What do they mean in the previous statement by
let me go back
emergent
one?
Trajectories?
This one here. In other words, the assumption is that the sex chromosomes for both birds and mammals naturally evolve from the autosome, so non-sex chromosomes. And so we know where they started and where they end up, but the trajectory is identical on both sides. But of course, the assumption is that this is happening by natural means. The assumption is the autosome was the starting component. From a creation perspective, God doesn't have to begin with the autosome. He could, make it from scratch, or he could begin with the autosome and re-engineer it. But given that God is involved, you can have the intelligent design there to bring about the identical outcomes in both cases. And again, from a creation perspective, you would anticipate that the Creator is going to maintain that optimality for both birds and mammals. And moreover, we'll be able to do it quickly. 100 million years is a very short period of time to pull this off from an evolutionary perspective. Okay, any more comments? Yes.
Why was it different for birds and for mammals? Is there an engineering reason why God designed it that way, or would it give them an advantage, or what?
I don't know the answer to that, and that's certainly not addressed in the paper, but it is something we observe, is that, with birds, it's the male that has the two common sex chromosomes. With mammals, it's the other way around. Is there some fundamental reason for that? I don't know. So,
well, a lot of the kings, some of the kings in history were killing their wives because they didn't have children. And, I mean, boys, and it was really the man that was determining the gender of the child.
Right. So, okay. I think I got time to give you one more before we get into this, and it pertains to what John Knight was talking about, and that is, it's also in this paper of Nature, the latest one, and it's a study on looking at, here it is, plankton. I don't have any slides for this, because I wasn't anticipating we'd be able to get this far, but since John mentioned it, I thought I'd be able to bring this up to you. What they've been observing for the past 100 years is a dramatic drop in the abundance of phytoplankton in the oceans. Now, that's serious because the phytoplankton in the oceans are responsible for about 2/3 of the oxygen-carbon dioxide cycle. Phytoplankton make up the majority of the green plant material on our planet. So about 2/3 of all the plant tissue on our planet would be these phytoplankton. And over the past 100 years, they've seen this serious drop. And what this article in Nature is doing is explaining how this drop was discovered. And, now we have satellite imagery to look at the oceans and measure the amount of chlorophyll, which is an indicator of how much phytoplankton you've got in the oceans. The problem is those satellite measurements have only been in effect for the past 10 years. In order to really be able to do something serious, you need to be able to go back at least a century. Well, what these researchers did, and this is what I like about this paper, they simply noted in reading through the literature that there's been this very simple technique that's been overlooked. And for over almost 120, 150 years, researchers, and basically they've been depending on captains of ships, what they do is they take this little white sphere and they drop it in the water, and they measure how deep they can put the sphere down before you can't see the white sphere anymore. I mean, what could be simpler than that? Just dropping a little white ball into the water and measuring when it becomes invisible to you. Well, apparently those kinds, I didn't know this, these kinds of measurements have been routine for about 150 years. And what the researchers are pointing out is those measurements are a proxy for the quantity of phytoplankton in the oceans. The more phytoplankton you have, the shorter the depth before that white ball disappears. They're basically measuring the transparency of ocean water. But what they point out, the transparency of ocean water is something that is related to the quantity of phytoplankton in the ocean, because most of the phytoplankton inhabit the surface areas of the world's oceans. And so by that means, we're able to determine that 8 out of 10 of the ocean basins of the world have been seriously depleted of phytoplankton over the past 100 years. Now, what caught my attention here is that they concluded that this is a signal that global warming is happening. In other words, they're assuming that the warmer the oceans get, the less phytoplankton you're going to have here, that warm oceans are bad news for phytoplankton. And the proof for that is they were able to show a very tight correlation between the rise in global temperatures and the drop-off of these phytoplankton. Now, in one sense, that makes sense, because phytoplankton are the number one means for life to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Phytoplankton take water and carbon dioxide, both powerful greenhouse gases, and convert them into sugars, starches, and fats. And as these phytoplankton die, they fall to the bottom of the ocean, sediments cover them over, and you wind up burying a lot of carbon dioxide and the water out of the atmosphere. So that's the most efficient means by which life pulls carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere in terms of what's going on in the ocean. There is another method that works on the land. And so, naturally, phytoplankton abundance will correlate with the temperature, the worldwide temperature, because now we don't have as much phytoplankton to pull carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere. But 2 weeks ago, I talked to you about whales. Remember the thing about the whales?
Fertilize.
How whales fertilize the surface areas of the ocean. And the more whales you've got, the more fertilizer you're putting on the oceans, which means you're going to have greater phytoplankton growth. You know, just looking at this paper, I took a different tact and said, okay, let's draw a correlation between the numbers of whales in the ocean and the phytoplankton, and you get also a really tight correlation. In other words, instead of saying, well, we have to do, you know, draconian measures to reduce the temperature of the atmosphere so we can pull the phytoplankton quantity up, why don't we just resurrect the whale populations, let them fertilize the oceans. That'll restore the phytoplankton to their pre-industrial revolution abundance, which is going to start pulling lots of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and be a real help for dealing with a global warming problem. And, by the way, a more economic solution to the global warming. I mean, the tough thing is you can say nobody can drive cars anymore or trucks, and we're going to shut down all the factories, and that'll help reduce the amount of emissions of carbon dioxide and water into the atmosphere. On the other hand, if we can boost the population of whales up, they'll fertilize the oceans, pull up carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And believe it or not, there were global warming advocates who were advocating getting rid of the whales. Remember that story I told you, how they said, well, whales expel huge quantities of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere just through their normal breeding. They're the biggest animals in the face of the earth, and if we can get rid of these big animals, that would mean we'll have a lot less carbon dioxide being pulled in the atmosphere. But what I shared with you 2 weeks ago, it is true that whales pump hundreds of thousands of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, but their fertilizer caused phytoplankton growth to happen at such a high rate that, in fact, the whales are a net contributor to the drawdown of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere of the Earth. In fact, all the stuff they breathe into the atmosphere, their fertilizer causes twice as much carbon dioxide to be removed from the atmosphere. And literally, this whole article, which shows this correlation between temperature and between phytoplankton mass, you actually get a tighter correlation if you correlate it with the feces of whales with respect to the quantity of phytoplankton on the oceans of the world. And wouldn't we all benefit if there were more whales? So I explained to you 2 weeks ago, if you got more whales, you got more phytoplankton. If you got more phytoplankton, you got more zooplankton. If you got more zooplankton, you got more fish. You get more seals. You get more sharks. Everybody benefits from having more whales on the planet. And also, I just did a little study this past week of how frequently whales are mentioned in the Bible. Over a dozen references to whales. Clearly, God really likes whales. And matter of fact, what was interesting to me is to calculate, as the sun's getting brighter and brighter through the conversion of hydrogen to helium, as you look at the fossil record, you can see how whales were created first in freshwater only, then in estuaries of rivers by the ocean where it's partly salt and partly water, and the whales gradually expand into the oceans. That's exactly what you would expect a creator to do in order to compensate for the increasing luminosity of the sun. Whales are huge, and if you've got lots of these huge whales, they can have a dramatic impact on the climate and can be a great tool for God to perfectly compensate for the changing luminosity of the sun. So the sun gets brighter and brighter. God makes sure that whales become more populous and more extensive over the oceans of the earth in a step-by-step process. So as the sun is getting gradually brighter and brighter, the whales are becoming more predominant and actually working to pull more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So as the sun gets brighter, the atmosphere becomes less efficient to trap heat. So a good example of how important it is to integrate across all the scientific disciplines in order to get an appropriate understanding. I mean, I think that's something Jeff Zwering really emphasized to you at that Orange County meeting. This can't be done by only looking at one discipline of science. If you look at only one discipline of science, you're going to get the wrong answer. And I think this article here is a classic example of that. They only looked at one discipline to try to get a conclusion on how to deal with global warming. An interdisciplinary approach actually shows you that a better solution. And also underlines the principle, God has designed the universe and the earth and life on the earth, so we human beings are faced with an ecological crisis. He has in advance provided us with a solution that is optimally ethical as well as optimally economic. So always beware when some politician tells you you have to sacrifice economics for ethics, or you have to sacrifice ethics for economics. God has designed things in such a way that we'll never face that kind of dilemma. But it doesn't mean that we're not going to have to work hard to find the answer that is simultaneously optimally ethical and optimally economic. Look for it, we'll find it. Yes.
Why did God create politicians?
Oh, you're telling me I'm out of time. Sorry. Oh, all right. Okay, you want to add some comments on the biology? And
later.
Later, all right. Okay, appreciate it. Yes?
I was wondering if the original intent of the light sphere measurements was to actually get a measurement of the Planck density. Was that always the intent?
No, not at all. I mean, that's what's wonderful about this paper is that the people doing the white ball measurements weren't interested in plankton at all. That was not their goal. Their goal is simply to measure the transparency of the water. I mean, what's brilliant about this paper is they said, you know, we can use this for another application. They were the ones that discovered that transparency of ocean water is directly proportional to the abundance of phytoplankton in the oceans. I mean, that's kind of the core of their paper. Is simply noting that, hey, you know, this is an unused tool that can be exploited for more than just measuring ocean transparency.
Why were they interested in the transparency at 150 years ago? I'm just curious what value that would have.
Well, the value it has is that if you have a big boat and you're running into shallow waters, it's good to know whether or not you're making... Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to run aground, and so having some knowledge of the transparency of the water does help.
Was that called sounding?
No, the technical term is. Let me get it for you. It's called SECHI depth determination, SECHI, and how these guys discovered this is they just said, well, we need something that's able to measure plankton abundance over at least 100 years. What tools have been used out there? And they found this is the only tool that exists. And so they looked at this and tried to see if there's a correlation. They discovered it. They wrote their paper and said they were able to actually determine the degree to which the phytoplankton populations have dropped and how catastrophically they dropped in different places. So... And also, where the whaling industries have been most aggressive is where you see the biggest impact. So actually, you can see a correlation with whales in that respect. Yes?
Was this the result of the recent Russian opening up of their maritime records? Is that where that came from?
Actually, these kinds of SECHI measurements have been done by captains of ships all over the world in all different nations. It's something that was routinely done. When you're on a boat for several months, you run out of things to do. So they have their sailors to do this, and for some reason the nautical people were very interested in measuring ocean transparency. The paper really doesn't address that, why these measurements were made, and I don't know the answer to that. But they were made, and they were made by all the sailing nations of the world for at least the past 100 years, in some cases the past 150. And so their whole point is this has got another use. So
I know this is like a question that the answer which would be too broad for your time, but I'm looking for a reference where I could look and find an explanation of the correlation between specific words in Genesis and what you're talking about here, the link or some kind of a nexus between the words that are in the Bible and the concepts of intelligent design.
Yeah, you'll see that at the back of the Genesis question. I actually give you, say, Genesis chapter 1 in English, and then we give you the Hebrew word that's there for every verb and noun in the text, and the adjectives and adverbs as well, and we give you a lexical definition. I mainly did that to make the point that most English translations, when it comes to the plants and the animals, choose very specific English words, when in fact the Hebrew words have quite broad definitions. And so, for example, when you get to creation day 3, where it talks about trees and fruit and seeds, the original Hebrew words are far more generic than that, and would actually include any plant that existed on the continental land masses. And so, because skeptics will say it's referring to deciduous trees. Well, some English translations will give you that impression, but the original Hebrew words are not specific to just deciduous trees. So that helps, you know, relieve the attack that people have said, you know, how can you have these plants so early in the creation story when the fossil record puts them quite late? And I think our last 2009 Discoveries booklet actually has an article in it on the discovery that plants were prolific on the continental land masses at least as far back as 850 million years. And creation day 5, in our opinion, is the Cambrian explosion event, 543 million years ago. So that particular discovery, published in Nature last year, definitely supports the biblical statement that plants predated the Cambrian explosion. So I think the booklet's there on the table if you want to take a look at it. In fact, you can read it without buying it. It's only a couple of pages long. Hey, with that, I'm out of time. Next week, please come prepared with some of your testimonies. And if things go slow, I'll give you some of my own. I gave you one last week. But let's pick up on a whole idea is this. We've looked at Psalm 104. Psalm 104 is one that told us that God's in complete control of the entire history of life on planet Earth, of all the species of life. He's the one responsible for all that, and all that's designed for the human species. And if God is that concerned about life that's not spiritual, how much more concerned would he be about those of us who have the image of God, body, soul, and spirit? And how in Psalm 139, the creation psalm that deals with human beings, we note that David is making the point that God is in total control of the day of our birth, the location of our birth, the day of our death, the location of our death, and everything else that happens in between. It's not accidents. We know it's not accidents because look at how God has been so carefully involved and miraculously intervening to make sure we get just the right history of life on the planet. How much more concerned would it be about our human beings? And what I want you to do next week is come armed with some testimonies of how God intervened in your own life in some supernatural way to preserve your life or to bring about the death of someone close to you for a good purpose. We've been through 25 examples in David's life. Let's hear some examples from your own life. I think it's just a good exercise for all of us to do, because so often we struggle and say, where is God in my life? He's there with you every day. He's intervening in your life. Everything is God's control on it. And we don't always know the purpose, but he is there. But I want some testimonies here. We heard some today. Look what we heard about the encounters. Oh, he's gone.
Yes, do this. The little stand out there.
Oh, he's got to do the little stand out there. Okay. Anyway, I'm over time. Let's just close. Father in heaven, we thank you for the amazing time in which we live, in which these discoveries are happening literally several times a day, giving us more evidence that you are the creator, the controller of the universe, of our solar system, Earth, and of life, and of us, our own individual lives. Father, I pray that you open up our eyes as we prepare for next week when we gather together again, that you'd remind us of the times back in our lives where you were there and you intervened in supernatural ways to preserve our lives and to preserve it for a purpose that you later revealed. Father, thank you that you love us to that degree. In Jesus' name, amen.
Have you seen this article? It's basically saying that the universe is part of some black hole, and it's got way too many equations and stuff.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay, just published, and doesn't say which journal it's going into yet.
No, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the tip off is that. Let me turn this off.